Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. I'm here for Mr. LaPointe. This, I should say, is the case of ADT Security against Lyle Woodridge Fire.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the Court. The District Court in this case stated that there's no evidence in the record that the plaintiff's systems have endangered people's lives and property. Of course not. There is no record in this case. There was no discovery allowed. There was no hearing taken at all before the injunction.
About statutory interpretation first, though?
Yes.
So do you think we need a record to interpret the statute?
As far as interpretation of the statute, no. You don't need to look at a record for that.
Okay. I take it given the procedural posture, you take the position, and frankly I tend to agree, we need to assume that the district's purposes were benign and that the district's new exclusive contract plan would be safer, faster, more reliable, given the absence of a record on those points.
That's correct, Your Honor. The point is we can't make these decisions to implement these systems unless they have a positive impact on life and safety.
Well, but we're I think Judge Hamilton is correctly saying, on this state of the record, one would have to assume that all of the things Judge Hamilton said are so.
It may or may not be the case, but for now, we will assume that.
True. That's very true.
So in other words, you don't need to worry about that in your oral argument time. Maybe that's the kind suggestion that's being given to you.
But that's what motivates Lyle Woodridge every single day.
Let's take the statute, though. I want to go to Section 1 of this statute.
Yes.
And the way that the Illinois courts have handled it.
Yes.
And I actually have some other things for you that are a little more far afield. But as I see the way Illinois has handled this statute, it's not been to assume that Section 1 is a broad, necessary, and proper kind of argument, but that in fact Section 1 is the kind of broad statement of purpose that the district court thought it was, and then when, say, fire sprinklers were wanted or when emergency ambulance service was wanted, the legislature had to add those powers to the law before they were properly exercisable.
Well, Your Honor, I was definitely going to address this issue today. There are two cases only. There's no history of cases, interpreting the authorities of fire protection districts within the statute. There are two.
Two cases is actually pretty good.
Right.
I don't know what in the world you live in, but we think two cases is.
Act has been around for 80 years, so in any event, let me address those two cases. The Glenview case, in that case, the court did not address the core authorities contained in Section 1. If you look at the Wilkes case, which, of course, decided that ambulance services was not included in Section 11, but it was included in Section 22. But if you look at the Wilkes case, under the Wilkes case, the court in that case stated that fire protection districts were fundamentally created, use those words, fundamentally created to perform the core functions to acquire, maintain, operate fire stations, vehicles, all these different instrumentalities, including apparatuses and equipment.
Well, sure, but this just requires interpretation. Why would you need to have to turn to any section other than Section 1 if your interpretation is correct? Why would the fire protection district not certainly have the authority to maintain a general emergency ambulance service?
That's exactly the authority that we have within Section
1. But not in Section 1, though, not according to Wilkes.
Well, Wilkes discussed ambulance services. Now, ambulance services has nothing to do with putting out fires, to prevent and control fires. That's the language that controls in Section 1. Ambulance services has nothing to do with preventing and controlling fires.
Well, then why? I don't think that's actually necessarily true. Certainly one of the primary things that fire fighters do is they ensure the safety and rescue of human beings and who may be affected by a fire, having the right equipment around when somebody's removed from a burning structure seems to me really quite central to what fire departments do.
Well, Your Honor, I don't think it really...
Your hearts, I'm glad they're doing it. That's a very important thing.
Certainly. Okay. And that should be something that goes along with putting out fires.
So if this prevention and control provision is the font of the authority, why in the Glenview case wasn't it recognized?
Well, the Glenview case, Your Honor, that turned on whether there was any authority to enact building codes for sprinkler systems on properties. So what the Glenview Court case said is that Section 1 does have regulatory authority, but it's directly tied and limited by the core language, again, of Section 1, which is to acquire, maintain, operate all the instrumentalities to prevent and control fire. That's what the Glenview Court said. That regulatory authority in Section 1 allows does not pertain to building codes. And when you think about that, it all makes sense. Because if you're telling a property owner how to construct their building, that really has nothing to do with preventing and controlling fires.
But fire sprinklers do.
Yeah, it sure does. I mean, whether you have flammable materials in certain places near other objects and so forth, and what materials are used and how the stairways are built and all of that.
But
part of that.
But it doesn't really go to the core responsibilities, the core authorities under Section 1 to acquire, maintain, operate all these other instrumentalities that go directly toward preventing and controlling fire. That's a third party. That's a property.
To be that strict about what those words mean, that I don't see why having a kind of alert system in your building is that either. That's not the fire truck rushing off to a building and, by whatever appropriate mechanism, stopping a fire. I mean, a next-door neighbor could call and say, I've noticed smoke.
Well, that's absolutely true.
Incidental.
Right. But, the point is, Your Honor, are there legitimate life safety concerns? Because that's the issue here.
It may not be the point.
I would have thought, look, Judge Shader and others have said Section 1 is the preamble. It gives us the purposes. I would have thought that you've got stronger arguments based on Section 11, Section 6, Section 10B, Section 11A, which in various ways provide more specifically the power to acquire personal property and to regulate, to control and prevent fires.
Right.
Why are you clinging to Section 1 so desperately, I guess?
Well, that's a good question, but, I mean, those are in our briefs, of course, all those other sections.
Well, let me ask you about one other thing where you seem to have inflicted a wound on yourself in the district court, and frankly, you've done it again here. You relied in your brief on Section 10A at page 15 of your brief here, saying that section that it provides a fire protection district the authority to, quote, sell, lease, or exchange personalty. You've left out the following language in the same sentence, and no longer needed for fire protection purposes. Judge Shader came down on you pretty hard for what looked like a deceptive omission there, and you've repeated it in your brief to our court, and frankly, I'm troubled by it.
Well, if you look at 10A, Your Honor, mm-hmm. It does talk about sell, lease, or exchange personally, and may sell or lease realty owned by the district and no longer needed for fire protection purposes. I don't think the latter clause applies to the whole.
That's an interesting argument. Don't you think that you, in fairness, should have included all of that language for us?
Well,
that's what Judge Shader had a problem with, and you repeated exactly the same problem in your appellate brief.
If we didn't include all the language, I apologize for that.
Well, Judge Shader was absolutely right about the interpretation of that language, and that has nothing to do with this.
Okay.
And actually, I want to step back and take a somewhat broader look at this. You are conflating two things that are really analytically quite separate. One of them is the standard that the village or the district, actually the fire protection district, is entitled to impose on any kind of alarm system. You know, maybe it needs to operate within 6 seconds, maybe it needs to operate within 2 seconds, 10 seconds, you know, not 136 seconds or whatever it was. That's a standard. And you could say no one whose system fails to meet that standard can operate these services in our jurisdiction. And that would be a different case from this one. To assume that a standard means that the village may be a monopolist is really quite a different thing. And I'm sure you're familiar with the Supreme Court's line of cases about antitrust liability of localities, since you originally had an antitrust claim. And you will recall that unless a state expressly authorizes, and the word expressly is important here, monopoly provision of some kind of thing, then there is no antitrust immunity. That's the Town of Hallie case. And it's something that, I mean, whatever else these various sections of the law may be, they certainly don't look to me like express authorization for you to oust competition and become a monopolist of something that's been a business for decades in this country.
Your Honor, yeah, that's actually a very good question, because if you look at what happened here, and it's happening not just in this district, but throughout Illinois and other districts, other municipalities, the same thing is happening. It's a joint partnership between government and private business, private enterprise.
That doesn't necessarily give you either antitrust immunity or anything else. First of all, you have to have express authority. The district has decided to do this. It's given the bid to Chicago Metro. I understand that that's, you know, the way it's decided to exercise the monopoly that it's creating. But monopoly itself is a problematic model when you're talking about business, when you oust competition.
Assuming there's a legitimate life safety issue here, life safety
concern.
The Supreme
Court specifically rejected that in the National Society of Professional Engineers case. Life safety issues do not, in and of themselves, justify elimination of competition. That was a case about bridge safety, so it was really a safety issue kind of case.
But, Your Honor, as you mentioned, you have to be able to point to specific authority.
And right, I think, and there you have, as you know, maybe not Section 1, maybe you have Section 11. I think there are issues, though, with the way the Illinois courts, getting back to where we started, Glenview and the Orland Fire Protection District case.
In our mind, Section 1 is the core authoritative language, because it is what it uses is all these different terms: vehicles, stations, apparatus, equipment, all these instrumentalities.
But why is an alarm system, before there's ever a fire, the kind of apparatus? Why isn't that just, you know, a truck or, you know, a hose or something?
Well, it's certainly those things as well. But this is a device that helps to control fires. And if you think about it this way, it is a device at the scene of the fire. And I know Judge Shader did talk about that there's some limitation based on this prevention and control, meaning, you know, at the scene of the fire. But this is a device at the scene. That wireless transmitting device.
So does this allow you also to monopolize the phone system, since that helps you learn about the fires?
Well, Your Honor, you know, the point is this, you know, there's no question.
That's a no.
Well, Your Honor, if there's a legitimate life safety concern, and we do have the authority to do this, and I think this allows us to do this, the authorities in the Act, I think, you know, the answer is we can do this.
All right. So let's for the time being, if, and I'm not saying anything about what's going to happen, but suppose we disagreed with you on the liability question. Your brief also mentions some points about the remedy that the district court ordered, and I don't want you to use up your time before you've had a chance to say something about that.
As far as the permanent injunction?
Right. The scope of the permanent injunction, and particularly the customer refunds.
Well, certainly the customer refund issue, Your Honor. What happened in that case is that plaintiff's counsel suggested that language be put into the permanent injunction. And we're not talking about refunds for prepayments. We're not talking about that at all. We're talking about some kind of difference in charges between what the customers were charged by the district and what they were charged before the implementation of the ordinance by the plaintiffs. Well, first of all, we're talking about apples and oranges. We're talking about two different systems, and the customers got what they paid for. They got a far superior system.
Well, but if the injunction is designed to restore the status quo ante, then a couple of things could happen. It could be that you were charging less than the companies were, in which case I assume the refund would be zero, so you wouldn't be paying anything. If you were charging more than the companies were, then if there is, in fact, standing to stand in for the customers, that struck me as a very interesting argument on your part, then perhaps there would need to be some kind of refund to restore the status quo ante. So I guess the question is whether the district court overstepped its boundaries in its effort to unwind what had happened. That's often difficult to do in the real world.
Well, certainly, you know, if you look at the proposals by the plaintiffs here, ADS and ADT, their proposals for the wireless transmission systems that they were going to implement were right on the mark as far as $66 per month.
Who charged more, the district or the plaintiffs, to the customers?
ADT, you know, they conceded to us after this discussion about the refunds and the permanent injunction. ADT admitted to us that the combination of phone line charges and the alarm monitoring network, that those combinations, you know, took them out of this.
Is that admitted on the record?
No.
Then it's not very helpful.
What's
the difference?
Can I address that, Your Honor?
Yes.
There is no record on this. That's the whole problem. We don't have any clear evidence on this at all.
Sorry for interrupting. I've got a question about your equitable estoppel argument. Are you saying that the plaintiffs are estopped because they failed to sue you earlier? Is that your argument?
Yes. There's case law in Illinois that says that if the plaintiffs wait too long to enforce their rights.
But you're not contending that the plaintiffs made some representation to the district that the code was sufficient or they were satisfied with it?
No.
Nothing they did affirmatively.
No. We're talking about a time lag. That's what we're talking about as far as that doctrine is concerned.
Also latches. If you want to save, speaking of time, any of your own time for rebuttal,
that's probably a good idea.
Invite you to do it now.
Let me raise one question with you. You can address it on rebuttal, and I'd like to hear from the plaintiffs on it as well.
Yes.
And that is, I'd like to know what the status is right now, today, and exactly when and how it is expected to change under the permanent injunction, so we know exactly what we're dealing with.
The permanent injunction is supposed to be requiring everybody to switch over by mid-December. I think the date is December 17th or the 16th or something right at that point. As of this date, there are still about 300 customers on the system. There is absolutely no way they can switch. No way they can switch. They can all be transferred by mid-December. That's not going to happen. There have only been about 20 and 30, I believe, that have actually switched. They don't want to switch.
Well, please just confine yourself to
sure.
The question.
Okay, thank you.
Okay. If you would like to save your last minute, then.
Thank you.
Mr. Goldsmith.
May it please the Court, I'll answer the last question first, and then I'd like to go on to talk about the statute. The order requires that the district be out of the business by December 14th.
Now, does that really mean Chicago Metro, or does it mean the district?
It means the district can no longer be operating a competing fire alarm monitoring system. The customers are to be returned to the original alarm companies. The contracts, as you were asking questions about the scope of the remedy, contracts were declared to be valid and binding so that the alarm companies could restore the relationship with the customers. I mean, part of the status quo ante was all of these customers were subject to customer contracts that were enforceable, they were automatically renewable, and we had long periods of relationships with these customers. But for the notice from the district, which declared the contracts null and void, those contractual relationships would have continued for years. We have customers in the district as well as the other alarm companies for up to 20 years. And as you might appreciate, once you have a fire alarm system, you need to maintain it, monitor it, and have it serviced. So that's a fairly near permanent relationship.
So there are 300, do you agree there are 300 alarms that need to be replaced by mid-December?
I don't know if that's the correct number. There's certainly at least a couple hundred. And most of them are former ADT customers, and ADT is in the process of converting them. It is not difficult to convert them, and it is not impossible that they couldn't be converted. We had some problems, and we actually had to file a contempt motion with respect to the implementation. The district, even at this late date, has argued in the reply brief that the customers shouldn't be required to go back to the original alarm companies. I've never understood that argument, but for their interference with the contracts, the contractual relationship would have been honored and continued. So,
given the situation, though, why shouldn't the customers be given the opportunity to choose among your different plaintiffs?
Well, it's not just a question among the plaintiffs.
And others.
Because the only reason that the contract was breached or terminated was the actions of the district, which were illegal.
But is it appropriate to have a district court order saying to customers who are not parties, you must contract again with the party you contracted with before?
Yes, that is the status quo. The status quo was these were all customers in good standing with their alarm companies
and
prior to the intervention of the district.
But what were the terms of their contracts?
They were automatically renewable contracts.
Well, that also means
full, yes, but also thus terminable. I mean, I had this similar question because I understand that the contracts ranged from 1 to 5 years. Most of them were about 3-year contracts. So if somebody wanted at the end of 3 years to switch, there's nothing that says they can't choose not to renew at that point.
That's correct. But the evidence was
the correct injunction from the district court, one that at a minimum takes that into account, which contracts were coming to the end of their natural term. I realize there was the beginning of this case when the district was actually trying to set aside contracts in force, which they flipped and flopped around a little bit about. But have they still done that, or are these contracts all contracts that had expired and then rolled over to the district system?
No. Most of these contracts were terminated prior to the end of their term on the notices.
So
that's
you would
first
think that
that
the status quo ante would be to at least finish the term that had existed until before the interference.
I would say that there's a practical consequence, too. If you had these customers at this late date having to look for an alarm company in order to get service to maintain continuity of service, it would be chaos in the district. The purpose of reinstating the contracts from Judge Shader's standpoint was to ensure that there would be continuity of service so that when we remove the radio that they removed from us to start this whole process and put a radio back on the wall, the customer's right back in business. Having to put them to the trouble of looking for another alarm company not only harms our goodwill, which we've established through many years of relationships with the customers, but it harms the ability to implement the order. The simplest thing is, in most cases, you have an alarm company that's providing services, including monitoring, to a customer. The district took away the monitoring function from those other functions, and putting the customer back is really just reestablishing the monitoring function with the other functions that they already have with their customers.
But there are two aspects of this. There's first the reinstatement of, let's just say, the remaining balance of those various contracts, and it's hard for me to see how you're entitled to much more than that. But secondly, there's this refund language, and I don't see how you have the right to get these refunds. First of all, this is money that the customers paid, and if they are bothered about it, they can bring their own lawsuit. If they don't bring their own lawsuit, why do you have the right to get them to prepay for your services going forward, if this is even a positive dollar amount, which it may not be?
Yeah. There's two answers to that. The first answer is that they were always paying in advance. So it's restoring the relationship that they had before. Judge Shader's order doesn't require doesn't give the alarm companies the money. It gives the alarm companies the money as a credit against future service by the customer.
But doesn't that freeze their ability to change companies? Suppose Chicago Metro decided, gee, you know, the Lyle Woodridge area looks like an attractive place to compete for us. We'd like to be in the pool. So we'd like to send, you know, mail to various people who live there and persuade them to change over to our service once they can do so. I mean, if you think of cell phones, you're bombarded with, you know, requests to change your service, even though most people are under 24-month contracts.
Fire safety is quite different than cell phone service.
I'm not sure. Contractually speaking, it seems to me the structure.
The simple answer is that, yes, at the end of a term, the customer is free to give notice of termination and to choose from the field. I mean, that's why the whole issue of monopolization is so.
Sure. And so I think, yeah, to be consistent, you have to follow through on that instead of paying yourself in advance. I'm not sure that.
I still haven't heard an answer to Judge Wood's question about why you all get the money, whether as a credit or in some other form.
Right.
Under the preliminary injunction, actually, they were required to credit the customer. I think Judge Shader felt, in order, because of the large number at the time of the preliminary, well, I think the simple answer is Judge Shader felt at this time to reestablish the relationship after the many months that occurred since the district took over service, that there had to be a series of things done. The contracts had to be reinstated, the customers had to get radios from us, and they had to get a credit against the payments they already made to the district for time of service that they were not going to get from the district.
All right, so here's a simple question that might make me feel better, depending on what the answer is. I'm just going to make up some months and numbers. So suppose there's a particular customer whose contract with ADT is supposed to expire on March 1st, 2012, and this money has been paid over by the district to ADT on behalf of that customer as a credit on their account, and the credit is bigger than the amount of money that's due between now and March 1st. So as of March 1st, they're still going to have $100 worth of credit sitting around. If they decide to terminate their relationship with ADT and go to one of your competitors, do they get the balance of that money paid back to them?
Yes. That's standard business practice.
So they will get that money if they don't want to go forward with you. Okay.
Mr. Goldsmith, let me ask you, let's get to the statutory question here. Would you agree that the statute authorizes the district to require that any alarms that are operating in the district, in these multifamily or commercial buildings, have a direct connection to the DuPage Communication Center?
No, I would not agree.
You don't think they can require that?
No. They could require any code. I'm sorry, let's make it. The district is bound to adhere to a code that parallels a national code. So as long as they parallel a national code, they can require whatever a national code requires.
Well, how about something the national code authorizes that doesn't require?
I believe that if the code, which is the NFPA code they adopted, permits a variety of monitoring methods. I would note that in this case it's irrelevant because ADS proposed to do automatic retransmission, which would have done the same thing as Direct Connect, and the district turned it down.
Well, I'm trying to take this a step at a time.
Okay.
Okay. You think that the language prescribe necessary regulations for prevention and control of fire therein does not authorize a direct connection requirement.
I do. Yes, okay. I do not.
I may disagree with you about that. What about a requirement, a regulatory requirement, for wireless radio transmission? Is that authorized or not?
A requirement to meet code by approved method of transmission, yes. Not a specified transmission.
And why not? Same reason?
Yes, because this goes back to Dillon's rule, which applies to fire protection districts. These districts have only those powers that are expressly given to them. If you take the fire suppression case...
We have to prescribe necessary regulations for prevention and control of fire therein.
That wasn't good enough to deal with fire suppression.
Okay, you're talking about the Glenview case.
Correct.
Right, but...
Go ahead. So then, I'm sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt you. The corrective there was that they amended Section 11 and provided that they can adopt codes paralleling national standards.
Mm-hmm.
So it was not a carte blanche, you know, do whatever you want. It was adopt a national code. I mean, these codes have been developed over the last 100 years.
Let me ask you, the third step in this that you don't want to take the first two steps. The third step, obviously, is whether the district can own and operate the system in question. I know you don't think that's true, but under your interpretation of the Act, what is the statutory authority for the fire district to own and operate the fire board and its other existing communication equipment?
There's a difference between the fire board and communication equipment.
Okay. What's the statutory authority for either one, both of them?
Well, there is no statutory authority to own their own board for fire alarm monitoring. There is statutory authority to have apparatus necessary relating to communication, which would be like a 911 service. You know,
how is that different than the board?
The board we're talking about is a piece of equipment that takes the signal from the residents, recommunicates that signal to DUCOM, which is the 911 center.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. There is no authority to take over that business.
Are they authorized to have a phone so that somebody can call them and say, please send a fire truck?
Of course.
Okay. What's the statutory authority for that, and how is the board different from that?
I would call your attention to 10B, which I believe specifically refers to communication device.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And why is the fire board not a communication device covered by 10B?
Because the history of this act is the control and prevention of fire. When this act was adopted in 1927, it was adopted so that communities that did not have municipal fire departments could have a fire department. Now, if we look at all the legislative history, and I don't mean textual history because there really isn't any, but if we look at the development of the act over time, every time there needed to be a specific authority, the legislature had to give that authority before it could be exercised.
A different interpretation of that history is that the statute was broad, the courts misunderstood it, and every time the courts said no, the legislature said no, we really want you to have this power.
Well, no, because, in fact, when the legislature deems a power to already be granted by statute, it normally puts in the legislation, this is a statement of existing law. And there is not a change in the act over all these years that ever has that additional phrase, this is an expression of existing law. I would.
Where do you find that?
There is, I would cite to you, the history of that kind of corrective action is found, for example, in Bank of Waukegan, which is a case at 626 Northeast 2nd, 245. It's a second district case, 1993. In that case, there was an annexation agreement with a zoning clause, and the issue was whether, when the annexation agreement expired, did the zoning expire as well. And the court ruled that the zoning expired with the expiration of the annexation agreement. The legislature amended the municipal code at 11-15.1-3 and said that, no, zoning is preserved after the expiration of annexation agreements. This is an expression of existing law. And that's how the legislature deals with situations where the courts have gone amok or the courts have not followed what is the legislature's view of its own history of the act. And in this case, when they corrected fire suppression, when they corrected addressing, which was something the Attorney General gave an opinion on that they didn't have the authority to do, they didn't have the authority to address buildings, which was necessary for the fast dispatch of fire equipment. Now,
but let me go back to the point that you were talking about a couple of minutes ago relating to the national code. I'm troubled by the proposition that fire protection districts in Illinois can't look at that national code and choose to do something that's even better. I mean, why isn't it just a floor? You seem to be saying it's a floor and a ceiling.
In a lot of ways, it balances a variety of safety interests based on...
I understand it tries to do that, but why can't a particular fire protection district like this one think that a different balance is better?
Well, if that were the case, then you would be treating fire protection districts like municipalities.
Well,
because
so,
then you would be.
So Lyle and Woodridge here could enact codes that would require direct connect, right? Can they do that?
Well, they're municipalities.
They're municipalities,
right?
They can do it. Right?
I believe that's
so
right.
So once they've done that, then why can't the district then adopt the same code?
Well,
the district can't have a lower code than the municipalities.
Well, you're making an assumption that Direct Connect is a higher standard. We would disagree with that. And there's substantial national information.
But you all cut off discovery and say we have to assume.
This case at this stage has nothing to do about those facts. It has to do about what is the extent of their authority. And the extent of their authority is circumscribed by the statute and by Dillon's rule. And so, yes, there are hypothetical ways to get to other objectives.
The fire district code has to be at least equal to what the municipal codes within the district are. Is that correct?
They are required where there's a conflict to follow the local, which would be municipal code. But I want to take the point. The facts that we do have on the record are that this ordinance allowed alternative transmission of alarm signals. And two companies submitted requests to the district to do radio-based automatic transmission alarm signals. In one case, Fox Valley, not one of the parties here, just was going to take the radio on the wall, reprogram it, send it through the board at the district into DUCOM. They were not allowed to do that. Alarm Detection offered to do the same thing either through that board or through another communication method to DUCOM, and that was not allowed. It's a permitted option under their own ordinance, and yet they wouldn't allow it. And that was only because, obviously, they didn't get their monopoly that way, because everybody could mirror what they want to do technologically. It was totally possible.
And you're saying the record reflects that these companies offered to do
absolutely.
That.
Absolutely.
So you would draw from that the inference that
it's in our complaint. It's in affidavits from Robert Lubick.
If I understand it right, that's an argument that the contract violates the ordinance, right? Is not authorized by the ordinance. I thought your main point is the ordinance is not authorized by the statute.
That is the main point. I'm saying to you that even if the issue was, can they do something better? Is there a safer way to do things?
You're saying it isn't, but if it were, right. Okay.
if the issue is, there's a safer way to do it, and here's what it is, and the district figured it out, even though we've been providing this kind of service for 12 years. The district came up with this thing, and they wanted this direct connection. We offered to do the direct connection. It would have been done with just an electronic switch, and yet they would not allow it to be done. And so that pretty much shows why what they were trying to do wasn't consistent with what their stated objective was, which they claim is safety, but in fact is monopolization. So I would like to take a little time to go back.
Time is actually expired, so I think we certainly have your briefs, and anything that wasn't covered here, we will turn to your briefs for.
Thank you for your time.
Thank you. Anything for you? I take it from you, Mr. LaPointe, that there is something further. So.
It's a good guess, Your Honor. Let me address some of the points that were just covered in Mr. Goldsmith's presentation. I'll be quick. As far as the retransmission proposals by the plaintiffs, that was barred by DUCOM. DUCOM, the other entity here that's not in court, their rules don't allow T1 lines, and that's the transmission, the direct connect into DUCOM. They don't allow that from private entities. They only allow it from public entities like Lyle Woodridge and so forth. So our hands were tied as far as that issue is concerned. Now, you know, we talk about the NFPA standards. Your Honors talked about those issues with Mr. Goldsmith. You know, the point is, in that regard, if you look at the Hinsdale case, they addressed the very same issue from the very same plaintiff, ADS.
But that was a municipality issue, not the same statute.
True. That's very true.
Would you agree that they were applying exactly the same legal standard, however, with a non-home rule entity with limited powers?
I was going to address that, Your Honor. Yes, it was a non-home rule entity, strict construction, only, you know, the powers addressed in the statute. And, in fact, if you look, as we said in our briefs, if you look at the statute, you know, the comparison of the statute, Municipal Code versus Fire Protection District Act, the authorities in the Fire Protection District Act are much more clear than Municipal Code. But the Hinsdale case said, we are aware of no legal authority that would prevent the village from adopting stricter building and fire code standards than those contained in national codes and regulations. But on top of that, we have something different than that. It's not just Section 11, which has permissive language. We may adopt national standards. We also have Section 1, again. We have a section that says we have separate power to regulate with respect to the instrumentalities for prevention and control of fire.
All right. Well, thank you very much. Thanks to all counsel. We will take the case under advisement. We're aware that this has all been expedited, and so we will attempt to take care of that. Court's in recess.